From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle. Coming up, if there's no contract deal for Los Angeles Unified School Teachers by this time next week, the leader of their union has promised they'll strike. Later this hour, we'll ask that leader, United Teachers Los Angeles President Alex Caputo-Pearl, what it will take to get him back to the table. But first, the Democrats take back the gavel in the U.S. House today. Will Nancy Pelosi be able to end the federal government shutdown? That's all ahead on Air Talk, right after the news. Thursday, January 3rd. Glad to have you with us here on Air Talk. I am Kyle Stokes, sitting in Larry Mantle's chair today, filling in for him for one more day. So glad to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School Districts are poised to call for the first strike in the district for more than 30 years, in more than 30 years, I should say. The head of the teachers union has set a deadline to reach a contract deal. That deadline is inching closer. Now, just 1 week from today, we speak with that union president, Alex Caputo-Pearl, about the on-again, off-again teacher contract talks in LAUSD, and we have an update for you on those talks in about 15 minutes. But first, a new Congress is getting seated today. Democrats now control the U.S. House. Nancy Pelosi is widely expected to win the speakership in an hour or so. We are expecting to see her reclaim the gavel as a federal government shutdown stretches into now its 13th day. That shutdown coming, of course, because President Trump is holding out for more than $5 billion in funding for a border wall. Democrats, of course, not wanting to cave in on that. I'm curious, if you are a federal employee impacted by this partial government shutdown, give us a call. We want to hear how it's affecting you. 866-888-93, I should say. Gave the pledge drive number, 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page on kpcc.org. How has this shutdown affected you as a federal employee? Give us a call. Joining me to discuss the developments in Congress, the seating of the new Democratic House, is Jennifer Habercorn, a Los Angeles Times reporter covering Congress in the D.C. Bureau. Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, catch us up on the shutdown here. President Trump met with congressional leaders yesterday trying to come to an agreement on border wall funding. How did the meeting go?
We're really at a stalemate. Yesterday's meeting was pegged by the White House as more of a briefing on the importance of border security. Democrats came out of that meeting saying that they don't see themselves getting any closer to the White House's position. The White House is, both sides are staying firm. The White House is saying, we need this border wall funding. Democrats saying, we'll give you border security, but no border wall funding. So I only see this stretching on a bit longer.
Border security funding versus the wall, how much, in dollar amounts, are we even hearing dollar amounts that the two sides are apart on? Is it $5 billion? It's $5 billion versus what?
Versus $1.3 billion. And while that's a lot of money in the grand scheme of the federal budget, it is a drop in the bucket. So in the scheme of what we're talking about here, the parties are not that far apart, but the politics and the symbolism here are extremely important. Democrats just oppose the wall, and they're not going to give any money to Donald Trump for it. And of course, the president campaigned on the wall. He campaigned on how important it was to do it, and so he doesn't feel like he wants to back down either. And most Republicans on Capitol Hill are standing behind him.
I'm curious if you can walk me through a little more the political calculation of that. Obviously, their motivations for the shutdown, but about the shutdown itself, do both sides just sort of feel like there's not that much that they have to lose by this? I'm just curious. Yes, it's obvious why they wouldn't want to support each other's proposals on spending, but why is a shutdown, sort of viewed as an acceptable option, at least for the time being?
That's the irony here, is that neither side really views a shutdown as a good idea, particularly Republicans, because as of at least an hour ago, they controlled all of Washington. And so most voters usually hold the party in power responsible for a shutdown. And in fact, Senator Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in the Senate, has said all along that he didn't want a shutdown and that it's horrible politics. He was very upfront with the idea that he didn't want one. But this was kind of not very well run from the start. The White House was a little unclear early in the process whether Trump was going to take a stand over this wall funding or not. In fact, the Senate voted unanimously for a bill that did not include wall funding. And then the president came out and said, no, this is a line in the sand. So this has been a very messy process. It's a pretty unusual shutdown because usually it's, one party kind of taking control and saying, we're going to do this. We saw Trump do that early on, and then he caved, and then he came back. And then we had the holidays in which there weren't real negotiations happening. So it's been very peculiar in terms of the shutdowns that we've seen in recent history.
Speaking with Jennifer Habercorn, an LA Times reporter who covers Congress out of D.C. Again, if you're a federal employee, I'm really interested to hear from you and how this partial government shutdown might be affecting your bottom line. We're seeing a lot of, reports out there in the media about federal employees saying that their possibility of going late on rent checks and things like this. If you're a federal employee, you're listening to the sound of my voice. I'd love to hear from you right now at 866-893-5722. Again, 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Jennifer Habercorn of the LA Times. Today, the House Democrats have scheduled votes on bills to reopen the shuttered parts of the government. What are the prospects for those bills?
So these bills will likely pass the House. Democrats took control of the House about an hour ago, and one of the first votes they'll cast is to reopen the government. They're going to vote on a bill that really just funds the government through September 30th, and then it takes Department of Homeland Security, which has been the controversial portion of the government funding dispute, and fund it only through February. Basically, they're kicking the can, saying, let's just reopen government. We can kind of work out this political squabble over the wall later, but let's get paychecks going to federal workers and things like that. So this will pass the House probably with mostly Democrat votes, but it will die in the Senate because the Senate is controlled by Republicans right now, and they've made an agreement that they're only going to vote on a bill if Trump supports it. Obviously, Trump would not support this bill right now. Democrats want to take a stand saying that we're taking control of the House today. We want to be responsible and fund the government, but it's not really going to lead to a permanent solution here.
Is the paycheck issue something that could force a resolution to this? I understand there's a paycheck that's coming in mid-January. Is that the light at the end of the tunnel here?
You know, when I'm trying to think through this process, I think that may be one of the flashpoints. I think once federal workers do miss a paycheck or miss two paychecks, I think we're going to see, as you were saying, you want your listeners to call in. That could be really difficult if people don't get a paycheck and rent is due or their mortgage is due, other payments are coming due. That could be a point where people really feel the burn, and that may be a point when the parties have to come together and restart negotiations in a more serious way.
I'd like to bring in Kent in Palisades. Kent, you say that the government shutdown is affecting you, not because you're a government worker, but because you own a small business.
Yeah, that's correct. Thanks for having me on the call. The issue is not only just government workers. In fact, I really suspect that the government worker effect is probably only a quarter or a third of those affected. We're a small business. We have a lot of government contracts, NASA, NOAA, National Science Foundation, and right now our contracts are not even being negotiated. Invoices for contracts that we already have are not being paid. That's simply because the government workers who are in those offices aren't there, and so it affects us being able to pay our employees. And it affects us being able to pay our suppliers. So the effect is probably an order of magnitude beyond just the government employees.
Right.
I think that point is often lost.
There's downstream effects to that. How many employees do you have, Kent?
We have 15 employees.
And what kind of contracts are you waiting to be paid out?
These are for space-related activities. So any kind of activity that's going on with space that's not a DOD contract is going to be affected, and that's across the country. That's That's just not in Southern California.
Are you changing course in any way? Is there any sort of contingency you're having to turn to make sure that you can keep the lights on?
What we have to do is we basically have to tell our suppliers that we're not able to pay them until we get the funding from our existing NASA contracts, for example. And for our employees, we're having to scramble to find alternate sources of revenue so we can at least pay them the minimum payments, you know, that they deserve.
How much longer do you think that you can sort of continue in this mode before it starts becoming really disruptive in some way?
You know, it's already disruptive, but I would say if this goes to the end of January, this is going to be a big effect on the economy, I think, because small businesses across the government, you know, have a lot of contracts, and you're going to see a lot of effect trickling around the entire economy.
Right.
For this.
Kent owns a small business, called us from Palisades. Really appreciate your call. Thank you very much, Kent. Jennifer Habercorn, LA Times reporter. Just speaking about this, I mean, yes, there is impact that goes downstream, that trickles downstream to small businesses like Kent's, federal workers obviously being out paychecks. On the other hand, we've endured so many of these shutdowns recently, and I wonder if people are just becoming inured to it. Like, do you think that people care? And more importantly, do the politicians that you cover think that people care about these shutdowns?
I think so. I do think over the holidays, it was kind of a weird time because lawmakers were not in Washington. I think people were more focused on, holiday plans and New Year's Eve than perhaps watching the news. So this shutdown may have gotten less attention and less feedback directly to lawmakers than previous ones. But to the point that your caller made about the downstream effects, you know, we're seeing the Smithsonian institutions here in Washington, some of them have to close their doors because so much time has lapsed. They were able to get by a couple days without getting government funding, but they're going to have to close their doors. We're seeing some national parks have to close up. You know, there's no garbage collection here on the streets in Washington. I've seen some overflowing garbage cans. So I think the more time that lapses, the more it is going to resonate with people. But so far, it's a little uncertain. And, you know, here in the Capitol, today is the first day of Democratic control of the House, so there's a lot of activity around that. But on the Senate side, where there hasn't been a change in power, there is a lot of conversation about the shutdown and how to move forward. And lawmakers are anxious to get that out of the way. But it's a matter of, the top folks in Washington, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell, and President Trump getting together and finding a solution that both parties can agree to.
Jennifer Habercorn, LA Times reporter, you have a story in the Times today about Democratic Congressman Brad Sherman from Northridge. He plans to introduce a series of articles of impeachment against President Trump, and it's really a reintroduction. He's introduced this measure before. Where does this stand? I mean, Jennifer, is this a stunt or is this a serious attempt at impeaching the president?
This is serious on his part. I spoke to Congressman Sherman yesterday on the phone, and he said this deserves to be before Congress. I believe everything that I've written in these articles of impeachment, but he's confident that it's not going to move anytime soon. In fact, he wants to see the Mueller investigation play out. But, you know, this is going to be something that Democrats are going to be talking about for 2 years, presumably. There are many liberal Democrats who feel like this should move forward. There's other moderate Democrats. And even Nancy Pelosi, the new House Speaker, has said, hold up, let's see what the Mueller investigation produces. If we were to pursue impeachment, it would have to be bipartisan and there would have to be overwhelming evidence.
Jennifer, just want to tick in one last question before we have to let you go. JSKDN, a writer on our AirTalk page, wondered about this impeachment measure and whether there's any possible intersection with the shutdown, writing, quote, how will that affect negotiations, presumably on the shutdown, since Pelosi has no votes to spare with those declared not to vote for her? Will winning the speakership change what Democrats are willing to do?
You know, I don't think so. You know, Nancy Pelosi seemed to have locked up the votes for Speaker before the holidays. Of course, the vote, it's actually happening right now. She hasn't yet secured it, but we're confident that she's going to. So I don't think it changes a whole lot, but I think Pelosi's appearance at the negotiations with President Trump in the Oval Office before the holidays really kind of excited Democrats about having her at the helm. They saw that she, you know, forcefully defended them before the president. And I think, if anything, that propelled Democrats who were maybe on the fence to vote for her. I think she'll get the votes she needs today with a couple more to spare.
Jennifer Habercorn is an LA Times reporter who covers Congress out of the D.C. Bureau. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're coming back right after a quick break with UTLA President Alex Caputo-Pearl, who's going to update us on the possibility that his members, 30,000 LAUSD teachers, might go out on strike. Back in a minute. The parents of 480,000 children in the LA Unified School District are now waiting to see what our next guest and the teachers union that he leads does next. Our guest is Alex Caputo-Pearl. He is the president of United Teachers Los Angeles, whose 30,000 members have been working without a contract for more than a year now and been in talks for a new contract off and on for going on 2 years now. UTLA has set a deadline for a week from today, January 10th, saying they will strike if there is no deal. Alex Caputo-Pearl, welcome to Air Talk.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
I do want to take you point by point through some of the issues that are at stake here, and I promise we will cover those issues in some depth. But so much of this dispute has been about process. Who's made an offer? What qualifies as even an offer? So let's start there. Within the last hour, UTLA, your union, put out a statement saying that you reject the district's most recent so-called offer, but that you are ready to go back to the table on Monday. So let's be clear here. What are you hoping that we can accomplish, potentially, if there's a meeting on Monday?
Yeah, we have a bargaining team of classroom educators, counselors, et cetera, who are have been trained in bargaining and who have been doing a great job. We got something over the holidays from the district that was pretty unclear, was an unorthodox way to make a proposal. We asked for clarity on that. They did not clarify it. So to the degree that we could understand what it was, we rejected it yesterday.
Alex, explain how it was that you felt that it was unorthodox. I think it's helpful to understand specifically.
Well, it was very unclear on many things. For example, Section 1.5 on class size, which allows the district to unilaterally raise class size, which parents and students and educators are very concerned about. It doesn't mention Section 1.5, even though that's been key, so that was strange that that's not in there anymore. It talked about $30 million being put towards class size and counselors, librarians, et cetera, and yet that's only, it's really a drop in the bucket for LAUSD. That's only 2% of the almost $2 billion reserve. That would put one additional staff person at only 30% of schools across LA. So the $30 million is not enough. And then it doesn't engage the other issues that we've brought to the table around limiting standardized testing so that we can have music and the arts and ethnic studies back in the curriculum, getting at more say for parents and educators around how school site budgets are spent. Basic common sense charter accountability continues to not get at those issues. So it wasn't formatted like a proposal. It was just sort of unprofessional. We did consider it as a proposal because they asked us to, and we rejected that because it's just very similar to what they've put across the table so far.
Well, so we can go point by point through some of those issues, but you say there are issues on which the district is refusing to engage with you. And I think the district might say, if you look at the table that you're referencing, the union, your union has published the emails in a statement on their website. I've linked to it on my Twitter account if you want to read through the whole email chain. The district might say, on some of the points that you're saying we're not engaging with, the district is saying we are engaging with them. We are asking that we accept the fact finder recommendation. The fact finder was a neutral third party that came in to weigh in and potentially, you know, map out a roadmap for resolving this dispute. And the fact finder said, we've got to drop a lot of issues. We've got to basically punt on a lot of these issues, tie them off, and focus on the big things being salaries, class sizes, and a few other things. The district might say, we are engaging with your proposal.
Well, certainly we know that there's going to have to be a compromise at the end of the day, and we understand that. But big ticket items like class size, which they have not put something satisfactory forward on, and staffing, like having enough nurses, librarians, counselors, as well as these issues that I mentioned of limiting standardized testing. You know, you have a student who goes from kindergarten through sixth grade in LAUSD could take more than 100 standardized tests over the course of that time, and it just crowds out from instructional time, music, the arts, ethnic studies, et cetera. So that's a big issue for us, the school site decision-making for parents and educators, being able to decide whether they want to hire, whether they want to buy a class size reduction teacher or a librarian. These are big things. So while we understand that we need to compromise and some other issues might have to fall off the table, those are the ones that I described are pretty foundational, along with charter accountability.
Now, just to be clear, are you saying that we want the district to put, I mean, you've talked about the formatting of this deal and the proposal. This is the district, what the district said on December 19th. They put it into sort of a rough table form. And I take your point that it isn't in contract legalese. But just to be clear, are you asking them to formalize an offer, put it into specific contract language just because you mean to reject it anyway? I mean, maybe it's short on details, but the district has a couple of different times tried to say, we do want to deal with Section 1.5, this class size provision in the contract that you find very onerous. They've said that, but you know, maybe it is in legalese. Is that the issue? Is it just that it's not in contract legalese, or is it something about the substance of the proposal?
No, Kyle, I just went through the substantive problems. The 1.5 is not included in the chart that they emailed to us on December 28th. The $30 million isn't enough. They're not engaging key issues that I went over. We do want to try to resolve this, which is why we put forward the idea of getting together on Monday and giving them an opportunity. We would like for them to come forward with a proposal. If they intend to delete Section 1.5 around class size, which would keep us from having over 45 students in secondary classrooms, over 35 students in fourth and fifth grade, which is atrocious, you know, high 20s in lower elementary. If they want to propose that, they should bring it on Monday. We've been at this for 20 months. We're a little bit skeptical when we receive things that are called proposals but are very vague. PERB has issued 3 complaints against the district for unfair bargaining practices. So forgive us if we're a little bit skeptical, but we want to try to work it out, which is why we put forward Monday. And we really want the superintendent to stop trying to narrow this just to salary. There's so much discussion about salary, and yes, our members deserve a fair wage, and we're going to fight for that. But this is about so much more than salary. We've got to get to these issues of class size, staffing, curriculum, standardized testing, a charter accountability, et cetera.
Salary, one of the issues that I promise we'll dive into the specific contract issues point by point with my guest, Alex Caputo-Pearl, the president of United Teachers Los Angeles. Just to sort of bring in another voice to the conversation, yesterday when Superintendent Austin Buettner was on the show, he said the district has put themselves out there, but now it's UTLA's turn to respond. I'd like to play just a little tape of what he had to say.
If they don't like our language, please come forward with different language. But to just say you don't like our language, when in good faith we've suggested something along the lines of what the fact finder said, they have an obligation to come forward with their proposal to solve it, not just to say we don't like what you said.
There have been, you say that some of what they have put forward is vague, but it's also all out there. I guess the question is now, isn't the ball in your court now? The district has shown what it essentially means to offer.
Well, we're on Monday, we're going to get into that conversation, provided that they accept to get together on Monday. And like I said, we get it that, you know, negotiations is give and take on both sides. I do want to say, though, that there is a threshold that the district needs to pass here. I mean, you've got an investment banker superintendent who has no education experience but lots of downsizing experience, who refuses to talk about privatization and charterization, which is undermining neighborhood public schools, and who is putting together a plan with national consultants that have privatized other school districts like Newark, Detroit, and others. We need, as a starting point for the district, they've got to start with proposals that actually indicate a basic willingness to stand up for district students, for the district itself, and for educators. And that hasn't happened yet. What we keep on getting is some crumbs thrown to us, but a continued agenda of withholding a historically high reserve, not really wanting to spend a lot out of that reserve, and moving on privatization plans that undermine neighborhood public schools. There is a basic threshold that the district has to cross here of showing a basic willingness to stand up for our district schools and students, and we haven't seen that yet.
Those issues, though, are issues on which the district has, from day one, said, we don't want to bargain that into the contract. Charter school regulation, one of the major issues that you want, you know, some sort of regulations around charter schools that share Los Angeles Unified campuses. The district has just said, we don't see this as part of the purview of the bargaining from the beginning. I mean, at some point, you know, don't we have to give up the ghost on the idea that the contract is the place where this kind of regulation is going to get done, that you as a powerful political organization start lobbying the school board, organizing, you know, creating political change as opposed to collective bargaining change around these issues?
Well, certainly if we have to end up striking, and we're going to do everything we can to avoid that, but if we have to end up striking, it will be about contractual issues that everyone agrees are legally bargainable issues, like some of the ones that I've gone over, class size, staffing, nurses, librarians, counselors, et cetera. But we do have to understand that everything that happens in LA is shaped by the mass privatization and charterization, and that includes bargaining, because you've got over $600 million per year that is drained out of the neighborhood public school system by the unregulated growth of charter schools. It is true, you're right, Kyle, that that's not a bargainable issue. But it does have to be dealt with because it is so tightly related to bargaining in terms of an annual drain out of the budget that is going to affect whether we can lower class size, whether we're going to be able to have librarians, nurses, et cetera. So we get the difference between bargainable issues and non-bargainable issues, but all of them have to be a part of this conversation. I will just raise also that what we've been looking for is a basic willingness on the part of the district to say, look, we're going to spend out of the reserve. We've got a close to $2 billion reserve in LAUSD, which is record-breaking. It's 25% of the budget, which is unheard of, in reserve. And it is just not fair to hold that in reserve and not spend it on our students, who are overwhelmingly low-income students, overwhelmingly students of color, who deserve equity and access and spending on our schools.
Just a comment that came in from Iris in Mar Vista that I'll just read to you. I'm an alumni of LAUSD, a current college student. Growing up, I found class sizes far too large and teachers were very frazzled due to high class size. Where do you think that the district should be putting its money into class size reduction? I mean, you know, maybe for Iris, there were class sizes that were large, but on the other hand, you know, the class sizes smaller than third grade are at 24. Should the money be put into later elementary grades? Should it be into middle school grades? Should it be into high school grades? Where do you want to see class size reduction?
Well, I mean, I look at my experience on this. I'm a parent of LAUSD kids. I've also got 22 years teaching experience in schools in South LA, which are some of the most impacted schools. And I've also been a community organizer around racial justice issues for decades. And there is no question that class size has an impact on our students in a way that few other issues do. So what the district needs to do is, for one thing, get rid of Section 1.5, which right now allows the district to unilaterally raise class sizes anytime it wants to.
Right.
That has to be a basic building block thing. What the district has said so far, they have said rhetorically that they will delete Section 1.5, but then in the next breath or in the next page of what they give us, they say that they essentially want to reconstruct 1.5 with 9 other conditions under which the district can unilaterally raise class size. That is first and foremost the thing that we need in order to cap class size so that we're not having 47 kids in a high school.
But then you have also said, in addition to that, that you want specific class size reductions in other grades. You don't want to just take away the district's ability to raise class sizes. You want to create a slower baseline of classes. What my question is where do you want those smaller class sizes? The district, this is a very expensive enterprise of class size reduction. Do you reduce them in elementary school, in middle school, high school? Where do you do this?
We need a scaffolded in effort to reduce class size across the board. We need it at all grade levels. It's unacceptable. When you've got 27 kindergartners in a classroom, and it's not all at 24, like you said, Kyle, that is an incredible experience. When you've got 37, 38 in fourth and fifth grade, when you've got 50 in high school. So we've got to start the project of lowering class size across the board.
But if you're trying to lay down a marker for the district to come back with a better offer, the district is not going to be able to provide across the board class size reduction. I mean, I think that's what they would say. I mean, where do we set a priority here?
Well, they would be able to start on across the board class size reduction, and here's why. At the end of the 2017-2018 school year, the district's own financial documents reported a $1.86 billion reserve. Then, last month in December, the district's own latest budget documents confirmed that that reserve was actually growing and would be close to $2 billion by the end of 2018-19. Add to that the district's projections around a fiscal cliff have consistently been off. 3 years ago, they said that the 2018 reserve would be $105 million. They were off by $1.7 billion. That's not a small amount to be off by.
Right.
They consistently overproject on books and supplies funding that should be going to students.
So there's reason to mistrust their budget numbers. I will pick up on that point with you, sir. Alex Caputo-Pearl, United Teachers Los Angeles president. We need to take a very quick break here, but when we return, I have more with the president of United Teachers Los Angeles with a deadline that has been set for a possible teacher strike in Los Angeles looming. I'll pick up with him with some of the issues that they are fighting for, the LAUSD teachers. But first, we have a news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Back with you on Air Talk, I'm Kyle Stokes, education reporter for KPCC, sitting in today for Larry Mantle. He should be back in this chair tomorrow. United Teachers Los Angeles, the union representing LAUSD school teachers, says that its bargaining team is available to meet on Monday the 7th. If the LA Unified School District has a legitimate and clear counteroffer to consider for the union to consider, this, of course, coming amid a bargaining dispute that's going on between the two sides that has the teachers on the brink of a possible teachers' strike. We just received a statement from LAUSD in response to this news saying, quote, "We welcome UTLA's willingness to return to a contract negotiation to avoid a strike that would do nothing to increase funding for public education and would only hurt students, families, and communities." I'm speaking with UTLA President Alex Caputo-Pearl about some of the issues that are at stake in this contract negotiation. And before I so rudely interrupted you, Alex, to go to break here, you were discussing the fact that there's a lot of reason to mistrust one of the foundational claims that the district makes here, that we can't afford the union's bargaining asks because there's a lot of reason to, A, distrust the district's financial projections of fiscal calamity, budget calamity coming down the pike, but also because the district has, as you point out, a $2 billion reserve. But of course, the district has said, we mean to spend all of this reserve in order to keep our budget balanced. You can see that in the budget documents too. And in addition, I'd ask, Alex, the district's put a lot of money behind its offer on salary, gradually increasing their offer for a salary increase for your members from zero at the beginning of this negotiation to 2% for a long time, now up to almost 6%. The question that I'd have for you is, isn't that evidence that the district, contrary to what you're saying, is dipping into its reserve?
Well, as it should, there's been 27% increase in cost of living in LA. And so in order to recruit and retain educators, teaching in some of the most challenging conditions in the state, of course we need movement on salary. But as I was saying, Kyle, at the end of 2017-18, LAUSD budget documents, $1.86 billion reserve. Last month in December, LAUSD budget documents saying that that would grow to almost $2 billion in the coming months. In addition to that, they're consistently off in their projections of a fiscal cliff. 3 years ago, they said that the reserve at this time would be $105 million. That's off by $1.7 billion, which is not a small amount to be off by. They consistently overproject by hundreds of millions of dollars in their books and supplies spending, which means that money's going somewhere, but not in the classrooms. And finally, the district doesn't even follow up with charter schools that are co-located to get the amount of money that should appropriately be given to the district, which is more millions of dollars left on the table. In addition to that, locally, you've got the state of California with a $15 billion reserve, also a record-breaking reserve, and a state surplus that's projected to be another $15 billion on top of that. So the money is there for our kids. The question is just, are we going to have the political will to put it into our schools?
Let's bracket in your argument that maybe the district doesn't have a strong ability to forecast its own finances, but you've made a very central claim of your public relations and all of this, that the district is hoarding this $2 billion reserve. I mean, can you concede at least that the district isn't sitting on that money, that it isn't, they're not locking it away and saying we won't spend it? I mean, that's been a very central claim that you've made. And I mean, they can point to budget documents and you can look at assigned balance numbers going up and up. It goes up to almost match that $2 billion reserve.
This is, they absolutely are holding on to a reserve inappropriately. This is straight out of billionaire Eli Broad's playbook of how you starve public school systems and make cuts and move more towards an unregulated charter environment, which is a privatized environment. This is straight out of playbooks that are easy to find online. So they're holding on to that reserve. Austin Buettner comes in with lots of experience on downsizing and cutting. He has no education experience. There's one reason you would bring someone in like that as superintendent, and that is to downsize and cut and privatize. So no, we're not backing away from that. What we want, and by the way, we're glad that they've agreed to meet on Monday, and we're going to go in there and we're going to make every effort that we can to come to an agreement. But it has to be an agreement that starts from the very central place of investing in our existing neighborhood public schools. That is where it needs to start.
All right, KPCC Air Talk, that's the program we're listening to. Excuse me there. We are talking, I wanted to say UTLA President, Alex Caputo-Pearl, speaking with me on KPCC. We are going to take a very short break and come right back with more conversation with the president of United Teachers Los Angeles, the union representing LAUSD teachers, with a possible strike looming, a deadline of January 10th, just a week away. Back in a minute. Back with United Teachers Los Angeles President Alex Caputo-Pearl here on AirTalk on 89.3 KPCC. Alex, a columnist in the LA Times, Gustavo Arellano, wrote that public sector unions, acknowledging public sector unions have been under attack, a systematic attack, really, over the past few years. And Arellano writes that that's a bad thing. But he also says that United Teachers Los Angeles holding out for an incrementally larger raise of 6.5% is a bad look. He writes, "What remains of Southern California's working class screamed, 'How about be happy you're getting any raise, let alone a retroactive one, in an era when family budgets are stretched to snapping?'" How do you respond to that?
Well, Arellano's article, unfortunately, had a bunch of errors and problems with it. But the main problem with it is that, just like Austin Buettner, he focuses on salary only. This struggle is about issues like 80% of our schools not having a full-time nurse. That's atrocious. And that is something that the parents and the public want teachers to be fighting for, and we will fight for that. One of the big issues here is just the way that Austin Buettner has been handling things. Yesterday is a good example. Yesterday he went out and bargained in the media, attempted to do that. He's attempted to stop teachers from talking to parents illegally about he's attempted to unlawfully stop us from talking to parents. They've refused to share some key budget documents, even though he says that they are. And yesterday he put out three different pieces of paper, one to parents, one to educators, and one to the media, that were all inconsistent with each other about their position. This is not someone who is trying to get to an agreement here. So again, we put forward the idea of getting together on Monday. We're glad that the district's going to do that. But our members are frustrated, not just with, you know, class sizes of 50 and 80% of schools not having a full-time nurse. They're also frustrated with Austin Buettner handling bargaining like a downsizer does, which is disrespectfully to students, parents, and educators.
You've criticized Buettner, in fact, for being inconsistent. We've been talking about that today. But they have been consistent on this point about a 6% salary increase. They've gradually taken off a lot of the strings attached to it. Now it's pretty stripped down. There it is, 3% back pay going back to 2017, 3% ongoing, 6%. Is that insufficient?
Well, there's still conditions on it, from what we understand. And again, their proposal, or their so-called proposal last night, was unclear on this. But it seems that they're still trying to cut.
They've said in a number of places that they've wanted to remove those conditions, as the fact finder recommended.
No, it's actually very inconsistent, Kyle. And in their proposal that they emailed on September 28th, it's silent on whether they're going to try to cut health care for future employees, which would affect students and families. We've got to recruit and retain educators in a national teacher shortage. And you're not going to do that by having employees right now decide to cut future employees, future teachers' health care. So salary is going to remain on the table. But what we're not going to do is just agree on salary and drop the other thing. So Arellano really misses the point. Now, all of this adds up to 98% of our members voting to authorize a strike because of these conditions in schools and because of the disrespect in the bargaining process. And parents are with us. Over 50,000 people got together and marched in downtown LA on December 15th. This is a movement to invest in our neighborhood public schools, and we're not backing away from that.
So on salary, I can't walk away from the salary issue without asking you, why are we still fighting about this? I mean, last year at this time, the district was offering 2%. You were at 7% to start this. We could have a deal today at 6%. Why are you not saying, great, done, sold, progress, now let's hammer out a deal on these other issues? I mean, why can't we stop fighting about this, declare a win? Isn't it a contradiction to say that we don't care so much about salary, and yet we're still fighting about it? Like, can't you end the fight?
Because our members and parents and students want a comprehensive agreement that, yes, includes salary, but also includes class size, nurses, counselors, standardized testing, music, arts, ethnic studies, et cetera.
But you're essentially getting the deal that you wanted. I mean, yes, there are concessions about health care. Maybe you could argue those at the table, but in broad strokes, the deal has a lot of what you want.
we're going for a comprehensive agreement that saves and expands and invests in our neighborhood public schools, and that's way beyond salary.
You've called for a nurse in every LAUSD school, a librarian in every middle and high school, more counselors, deans, social workers in every secondary school. The district estimates that this would cost a total of more than $500 million, which is much more in their estimation. This comes from July, but a lot of this is in relation to your last best and final offer. I guess I'm just curious, how can you expect the district to agree to demands that are so expensive?
So I've gone through the finances and about the reserve, the reserve that's grown over the last 5 years,
right,
expected to grow again. I've gone over the books and supplies slush fund. I've gone over the district not charging charter schools to co-locate. So what the district can do is actually spend out of the money that I've just identified to get us going on real investment in our neighborhood public schools. And then, yes, do what Buettner has talked about, which is work together at the state level for additional funding. And let's have a comprehensive plan over the next 5 years that includes spending money that the district has now, right now, and approaching the state. Now, the problem with the way Austin Buettner is talking about state funding is that he's trying to just redirect to the state and forget about the money struggles here within LAUSD. We're not going to do that. But we do agree that, of course, we need to approach the state together. And Austin Buettner can do two things right now, today, to advance the fight at the state level. And by the way, as you know, California is 43rd out of 50 among the states in per pupil funding, which is criminal. And it's a racial justice issue in the sense that as the proportion of students of color has gone up in California, the per pupil spending has gone down. So this is educational justice and racial justice. The two things that Austin Buettner can do immediately around state funding are, number one, find a legislative sponsor to bring back the bill that we attempted to bring in Sacramento last year to close the carried interest loophole. This is where hedge fund managers like Austin Buettner, private equity people like Austin Buettner, get to inappropriately classify their income as capital gains and therefore be taxed less on it. That is Austin Buettner's set of colleagues. He could, in the snap of a finger, have a legislative sponsor and get the industry behind that, and that's $1 billion for public schools in California. The second thing he could do immediately on state funding today is initiate with Eli Broad, who he works very closely with, and other billionaires who say that they're concerned about schools, is initiate an effort to get wealthy commercial property owners to create a committee in support of Schools and Communities First. Schools and Communities First is going to be on the ballot. It has already qualified for November of 2020.
This is the commercial property tax Prop 13 reform. If I want to get in one last question, Mr. Caputo-Pearl, and I'm apologize for cutting you off, but I want to ask, because the union has scoffed basically at claims that LAUSD is veering toward insolvency, a strike. You know, it would, no matter whether the district is headed to insolvency or not, it would still cost the district a lot of money in student attendance before it even enters its second day. I mean, it would cost, if it lasted more than 3 or 4 days, it could cost more than $100 million. I mean, after not a very long strike. I mean, this is just sort of back of the napkin math. Doesn't this sort of make it difficult in 30 or 40 seconds? Doesn't it make it difficult to call for a strike? Because even if it lasts for a short time, it undercuts your own demands.
Well, just very quickly, that Prop 13 reform of Schools and Communities First is just to close the corporate loophole. It would only affect wealthy commercial property owners, not homeowners. Second thing is, we have been overwhelmed with the amount of support from parents and community organizations. And what people are saying overwhelmingly is, if it takes a disruption and inconvenience of a short period of time to right some wrongs that have lasted for decades and to make sure that the school system is not privatized, then it is going to be worth that inconvenience and disruption.
Right. United Teachers Los Angeles President Alex Caputo-Pearl on Air Talk on KPCC.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Glad to be with you for a second hour of Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I am Kyle Stokes, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Larry will be back from his very well-deserved vacation tomorrow. Coming up this hour, Governor-elect Newsom is about to take office with money to burn potentially, but do his plans call for more spending or more of outgoing Governor Jerry Brown's fiscal moderation? But first, a story in the New York Times caught our attention because it raised this question. Does how partisan you are affect how you judge how biased the media is? This was an interesting study. The folks at Gallup and the Knight Foundation showed news articles to a nationally representative group of study participants. And the more partisan the participants said they were, the more likely they were to rate the news as biased. In other words, it raises the question, is news media bias in the eye of the beholder? I want to hear from you. Have you changed your news media consumption habits? Because either you want to correct for your own biases and you recognize them, or because the news outlets that you were reading themselves became biased in your opinion. Want to hear your thoughts on this? Give us a call. 866-893-KPCC is the number to call. Again, 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. With me is Jonathan Rothwell, the principal economist at Gallup and research consultant for the partnership between Gallup and the Knight Foundation, which designed and executed this experiment. Jonathan, thank you for being with us. Welcome to AirTalk.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, can you talk me through how this study worked?
Yeah, so first we at Gallup, my colleagues created a News Lens website, which basically is a news aggregation feeder that was designed specifically for this study, and it allowed participants who previously had taken Gallup surveys and indicated they'd be interested in participating in future research to log in for free to the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and several other prominent news sources. And if they were an experimental group, they were shown the news articles without knowing the source of the news. And if they're in the control group, they read news articles as they normally would from any news aggregation website.
So one half saw the source, one half did not see the source.
That's right. And then they were asked to rate the trustworthiness of the specific news article when they were finished reading it. And so that formed the basis of our database.
Some of the results of that were quite interesting. Obviously, the top line being that if you were more partisan in your own self-reported political leanings, that you are more likely to see the news article as biased. Is that right? Can you talk me through what it found?
That's right. So one way of quantifying this is by looking at what percentage of people exhibited a somewhat extreme bias. And so if you look, the trustworthiness ratings were on a 1 to 5 scale in increments of half a point. And I used a cutoff of 1.5 percentage points as a fairly large difference. And so what I was looking at is the difference between how people who were blind to the source, and so they were unbiased with respect to the name of the provider, how their trustworthiness ratings compared to people who were exposed to the name of the content provider. And when those differences were large, the idea is that that's an indicator of larger bias on behalf of the reader. And so when if you break down which groups exhibited the largest bias, it was people who said they were either very conservative or very liberal. And so in both cases, about 43% of readers exhibited fairly extreme bias if they were very conservative or very liberal. And that compares to people who say their political ideology is moderate, they only exhibited bias 31% of the time.
I thought it was really interesting that those who identified as leaning toward the Democratic Party or most strongly affiliating with the Democratic Party, I should say, who read media perceived it as right-leaning, like Fox News, rated it higher when they did not – rated it more trustworthy, that is, when they did not know the source. So there is an actual possibility for Democrats to trust Fox News. Ardent Democrats just stripped the Fox News label off of that. Is that surprising?
Yes, just to some extent, I suppose. I think what's going on there is it's not that when they were blinded, they necessarily rated Fox as the most trustworthy source. We didn't find that, but there was a significant difference when Democrats were confronted with Fox News. So they were definitely more likely to rate it with give it a higher rating when they did not know it was Fox News. So I think the way to interpret that is not necessarily that Fox News is the best provider, or we actually found that it was fairly low even when people were not aware of its source, but that Democrats do confront Fox News with bias, and there probably is some legitimate content that Democrats would agree with and find to be balanced, and that some elements of Fox News, at least, especially on the online reporting page, I should say, mm-hmm. We did not do this experiment with the Fox News broadcasters, who are notorious for exhibiting extreme forms of bias.
And might elicit a little bit more of a visceral reaction. Jonathan Rothwell, principal economist at Gallup, is with me talking about a really interesting study that he put together. I want to hear from you. Are you a closet Democrat but also Fox News reader? Out yourself on our AirTalk page at kpcc.org, or give us a call, 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Really, the question, as I've said before, what I'm interested to hear from is those of you out there who may have changed your media consumption habits to correct either for your own biases or because you feel that the news media outlets that you were reading before had themselves become biased. With me also to discuss this article is Jane Kirtley, a professor of media ethics and law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Jane Kirtley, Sky Yuma, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kyle.
Did this study surprise you?
Well, I think it's one of those things, and I think we'll probably be talking about the issue of confirmation bias.
Right.
It confirms what I probably would have suspected would be the case.
It confirmed your confirmation bias theory.
Exactly. In a blind testing, as it were, when you strip away whatever prejudices you have about the reliability or lack thereof of a news outlet, you may find it more trustworthy than you might expect. I think the point that was made earlier about the fact that what you were looking at in terms of the Fox News material was not the over-the-air or the cable commentary, but the straight news reporting, it doesn't surprise me that that is factually accurate to a great extent. I just got back from London, and I read the Times of London, and, it's very conservative in its viewpoint, but its straight news reporting is, to me, reliable. I trust what I read there. So in and of itself, that doesn't surprise me so much. But I do think that what this underscores is that there is a perception among the reading and viewing news-consuming public that all of the news media have an agenda. They have an opinion. They have a bias, and that, therefore, nothing you can read is going to be something you can trust implicitly. That, to me, is a very scary thing, because we can certainly disagree on opinions and viewpoints, but if we can't come to a conclusion about facts, basic facts, then how can we even have a discussion? So this study I find very interesting. I'm not sure where we go from here with it, though.
Yeah, thank you very much for that thought here. Hayden in Palm Springs is joining us. Hayden, welcome to AirTalk.
Yes, good morning. I definitely find myself leaning left more than right. However, as opposed to being biased based on the partisanship of the news source, I tend to be a lot more biased based on whether or not it is a highly commercialized news source, in that MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, these are all the same to me. They're highly partisanized, so I don't take them as fact. But despite the fact that I do lean left, I will read the National Review and consider it journalism, because the National Review does not seem to be so profit-focused. Or the same thing with NPR and its various affiliates. I find that news that does not have a lot of money tied to it tends to be much better. And I'm just curious if the experts have explored any of that in their studies as well.
I'll ask them in just a second here, but Hayden, I'm curious. You say corporate or commercial. Do you mean for-profit? Because NPR bringing up, obviously, NPR comprised of a bunch of not-for-profit organizations. Do you view, the New York Times, the Washington Post, for-profit enterprises, famously so? To what extent do you think that corporate or commercial for-profit is the problem?
Quite frankly, I do tend to read a lot of the New York Times is an excellent example. I will read it, and I do consider it journalism, but that is maybe my second string journalism that I consume, because when I read it on NPR or I read it from BBC, you know, these are things that I consider. I think it has more to do with how heavily commercialized it is, I might say, whereas on Fox News or on MSNBC or CNN, if you watch that on television, it's very obviously for the bottom line. Whereas when you read something like the New York Times, though it is for profit, it seems less, it just seems like less corporate shilling. I hate to be that guy right now, but it's one of those things. It's like obscenity. You know, it's hard to draw the exact line, but when you see it, you know it.
Right. We'll record this and play it during our next pledge drive. Hayden, thank you so much for calling in. Professor Kirtley from the University of Minnesota, I'm wondering if you can weigh in on this, too. I mean, do you think that people may be reacting to blatant profit motive, ratings motive, clickbait?
Well, let's be real clear. The model in the United States for the news media for a very long time has been for profit. I mean, we're talking back to the revolutionary era, so there's nothing new or novel about that. I think the caller may be reflecting on the concerns that many have raised about the concentration of ownership in a few powerful entities, and I agree that that is something that is concerning, because we'd like to see a diversity of voices and viewpoints, and that's not always going to be the case. But to say that inherently it's evil if you're trying to make money in the news business, I think is missing what has been the model in this country, not always the model in other countries where there is more of a tradition of public service broadcasting and publishing and so forth, but that's not really our tradition here. I think rather what has happened is that we've sort of lost our way in terms of what the mission of the news media are supposed to be primarily. You can make money. You know, the Graham family that owned the Washington Post made a lot of money, but they were also courageous in taking on the Nixon administration and so forth. And they did that, you know, I won't say totally oblivious to what the impact on their bottom line would be, but taking it into account that that was what their mission was all about. So I get what the caller is talking about, and I certainly share the concern about concentration of ownership. But again, to simply say if you're not for profit or that's not your main motive, you're going to inherently be better, you could say that about a lot of extreme outlets on both sides of the political spectrum, which I would not consider to be reliable sources of information at all.
Let me bring into the conversation Jeffrey McCall, who's a professor of communication at DePauw University in Indiana, who's a former journalist, a columnist for The Hill. Professor McCall, thank you so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
I'm curious to hear how you would react to this caller's sort of observation here about the motive of the organization. How do you think that plays into our perception?
Well, Professor Kirtley's responses were all very great, and I agree with those. I think it is worth noting that really all news organizations want as much traffic and many clicks and as much viewership and as many eyeballs as they can get. So even the not-for-profit ones still need people to go to that site. And even the not-for-profit sites still need to get their funding from someplace, and they need to prove their reliability and their functionability as well. So even the places that are not quote-unquote profit-driven still have motivations to generate a popular audience at a certain point. But I would like to think that the not-for-profit journalism industry is not as driven specifically to try to push agendas or perhaps to be only interested in how many clicks or eyeballs they can get, because they would like to think, we would like to think that they have a greater calling. And I think there's a lot to be said for the not-for-profit journalism world. And honestly, I wish they had a bigger share of the news-consuming market.
I didn't intend for this segment to become a giant commercial for NPR, but here we go. I think that the deeper question we're all pointing at here, Professor McCall, is does the American public trust the news media? I mean, it's sort of a bottom line question, and I guess I'd love to sort of get your sort of bottom line take on that.
Well, you know, credibility studies have shown over the last 15, 20 years that the public trust in the media is declining, and I think it's a multifaceted kind of decline, and it's hard to point at any one particular reason for that. One thing I think we note here, and getting back to the study here that Jonathan Rothwell helped tell us about, is that I think we know that a lot of news consumers now are making very global evaluations of the sources of news, and the study that they've executed here demonstrates, and we were talking about Fox News, for example, that when you look at a Fox News story on the web, it might seem relatively unbiased or straightforward or fact-based. But when you just go down the street and talk to somebody and say, what do you think about Fox News? Many of them will just instantly go to say, oh, it's biased or it leans right or whatever, or they don't like the opinion shows that they have in the evening.
Right.
And I think that's one thing to make a big distinction here is that you can't look at really any news organization in a totally global sense, because of getting back again to Fox News, you've got the Fox News website, which based on this study comes off, you know, okay. But then you've also got Fox News on-air news shows like Brett Baer's at 6 o'clock or Shepard Smith in the afternoon or Stream at 11, and those are generally, I think, relatively sound programs that are not, you know, trying to, you know, blatantly push agendas, because Shannon Bream is a journalist. Bill Hemmer in the morning is a journalist. Shepard Smith is a journalist. But most people identify Fox News, for example, by the opinion shows that are very pointed in the evening when you've got Sean Hannity or Tucker Carlson or Laura Ingraham. And so a lot of people would say, oh, I never watch Fox News. It's too biased. And you're like, well, number one, have you ever watched it? And the answer is many times no. But number two, are you talking about Fox News on the website? Are you talking about Fox News with Shepard Smith in the afternoon? Are you talking about Fox News as identified with Sean Hannity? And those are all different things. But
I think you could make that point generally when people say the words the media, you know, that the media is biased. And there's a certain amount of that that I have to take ownership in crafting this segment and saying that. And we'd have to be careful not to use the word the media as a blanket term for the exact reason that you're saying, Professor Jeffrey McCall of DePauw University. I want to go to Norma on our AirTalk page writes, bias is not the problem. Our news is getting so clickbait driven. All personalities and horse races, few in-depth explanations, discussion of issues and policies. Alex on the AirTalk message page, sound like an old fuddy, on Facebook, he goes to AirTalk on Facebook, says, I consider myself very liberal. I used to love MSNBC, but I stopped watching them after the way that their hosts handled the Clinton-Sanders primary debates and in the aftermath of Trump's abortion comments. They focused heavily on Clinton's rebuttal all night and did not mention Sanders' rebuttal until the next day. After that, I realized even though I agreed with their politics, their bias could still be as damaging as others. Jonathan Rothwell, we're talking about your study here. You're the economist at Gallup, and you put together this interesting study about blinding people to the source of the information makes them a little bit more trusting of it. You write in the New York Times about the chicken and the egg question here, that is this because the outlets create the bias and then it feeds off of that, or is it because consumers are seeking the information that confirms their own biases? How do you sort of balance those two? Which do you think is a more plausible explanation?
Well, I think it's probably some combination of both. It's from our study, we can't know for sure. We're in our partnership with the Knight Foundation, we're digging into this issue across a number of different studies, and we've asked the American public what they think, and actually it's interesting. About half of them say it's the responsibility of news media organizations, and about half of them say it's the individual reader's responsibility. So the public seems to agree that it's both parties are at fault, so to speak.
Interesting. Talking with Jonathan Rothwell, the principal economist at Gallup, who put together a study on blinding viewers to the sources of news. And when you do that, you generally get that more trustworthy. So even someone who would lean closely to the Democratic Party might rate a Fox News story a little bit higher than they might otherwise would if they saw that Fox News label on it. We're going to continue to discuss this study and what it says about Americans' news media literacy. Back in a minute here on Air Talk. Talking about an interesting study here on Air Talk, the folks at Gallup and the Knight Foundation showed news articles to a nationally representative group of study participants. And the more partisan the participant said that they were in their leanings toward left or right candidates, the more extreme their views were, the more likely they were to rate the news as biased. With me, a panel of experts talking about this. Jane Kirtley, a professor of media ethics and law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. I want to ask you about what you think the implication of this study is. One of the thoughts that I had was maybe that this is good news for media literacy, that it shows that people are skeptical enough of what they're reading.
Well, I think that would be one interpretation, and I always like to take an optimistic line whenever possible. But I think something that Jonathan said at the outset of this segment was that part of what they were discovering was that people were relating or evaluating things as reliable and so forth if they agreed with it. I think that was the way he phrased it. And this goes back to the confirmation bias that we talked about earlier on. If my goal as a reader, viewer, consumer of news is to find the material that I agree with, then what that tells me is that I'm living in a golden age because given the nature of media today, I can cherry pick. I can structure my news feeds from social media so that I only get the stuff I agree with and I don't have to be challenged in any way. That's not news literacy. That's not media literacy, in my opinion. That's living in a bubble. And, you know, it's great to think that people will go out and, you know, choose from the buffet of information sources that are out there. But I think the studies show that people typically do not for some of the reasons that Jonathan shows, which is, you know, you gravitate toward the things that are going to reinforce the views you already have. So there's optimism here, but I also think this is indicative of what I see as a very damaging trend for American society, because if we can't agree on a basic set of facts, I don't see how we can move forward with public policy decisions.
Yeah. Professor Jeffrey McCall of DePauw University in Indiana, a quick parting thought to you as well. I mean, again, the same bottom line question. What is the implication of this study?
Well, I think it does show that news consumers really do need to work if they want to be fully informed, and that includes going to a variety of sources, including ones that maybe they think are not right up their alley or confirm their biases, as we've talked about. And one last thing, I think, is that even though this study does suggest that news consumers are somewhat to blame for the kinds of media bias results that they seem to report, I think we still need to hold the news industry's feet to the fire and challenge them to be better and to be as fair and professional as possible. Fairness is a skill, and I think we need to remind all people in the news industry, really work on being as fair as possible and try to get away from this kind of cultural sense that all the media are biased and that we should kick them all out as unbiased.
Jeffrey McCall, professor of communication at the Jewel of Greencastle, Indiana, DePauw University. Thank you so much for joining us. Also, my thanks to Jane Kirtley, the professor of media ethics and law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Minnesotans get shout outs on this show while I'm guest hosting. Thank you to you both for joining us here on Air Talk. We'll be back after a short break. We're just a few days away from Governor-elect Gavin Newsom's inauguration. He's getting sworn in on Monday as California's 40th governor, taking the reins from outgoing Jerry Brown, a fiscal hawk whose parting gift for his successor includes a budget surplus recently estimated at nearly $15 billion. And there are a lot of people who want to see the governor spend that money. Since the state legislature went into session, California lawmakers have introduced a whole bunch of bills that could translate to tens of billions of dollars in new spending. But the question is, what are Governor-elect Newsom's priorities? And with me to discuss that is John Myers, the Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You broke a story yesterday that Newsom is planning to devote nearly $2 billion to early childhood programs.
Yeah, it's a first look at what we expect from the budget that he will have to submit to the legislature pretty quickly. Governors have to do that by January 10th, so he takes the oath on Monday and then has got to turn around and have a spending plan, and he's been working on that over this transition period. But the first glimpse that we get is something he talked on the campaign trail a lot about, improving the outcome for children ages 0 to 5, especially those from low-income families. This is close to $2 billion. Most of it is one-time money, and what that means is it's a one-time infusion on efforts to help some of these programs get up off the ground. But that's going to be the real push, I think, here as to whether or not this is enough or whether lawmakers in Sacramento want to continue these programs year after year, which, of course, would cost a lot more money.
I've seen the governor-elect talking about needing to build the infrastructure for something like a universal preschool program. To what extent is this money going to go to the existing K-12 school district structure? To what extent is this new programming? To what extent are there already places that can receive this money?
It's a little bit of a boost, I would say, at this point. The Newsom camp is calling it more than a little boost. They're saying it's the most substantial in recorded time or something to that effect. But I think that's part of the messaging, of course, of a new governor wanting to get the ground running. But if you look at this, the most of it is split between two things. The first is trying to boost kindergarten funding, $750 million he'll propose to trying to get schools to go to full-day kindergarten, not these partial-day classes. I have young kids. I can tell you, My son was in kindergarten. It let out early. If you're a family that has a job that you can't leave the job early, what do you do with the kid? This money would try to have full-day kindergarten in the school districts that do not have it now. And then the other half of the big chunk, also about $750 million, is to help train child care workers, expand child care facilities. Again, we know working parents and working poor parents have struggled to find child care that they can afford, and also the training for those child care workers so they actually are providing a quality experience for those kids. Those things are the bulk of the money. There's a little bit for helping expecting parents know what to coming down the pike and how to be ready for that, to prepare their house for a home for a child. But these are infusions of cash, and they align very closely with what Democrats in Sacramento have been talking about for a long time, which is a new focus on early childhood. I think there's a lot of people who are pleased by what they've seen out of this.
Of course, state lawmakers, mostly Democrats. Of course, the Democrats solidifying their holds on both chambers in Sacramento. And Democrats have talked about early childhood. They're also talking this year about a lot of other big issues. I'm wondering if you can walk me through what else we're seeing in the Assembly and in the State Senate around ways to spend what could be a pretty large surplus, or at least spend more money from the state anyway.
Well, it's going to be the biggest part of the Newsom first year of the Newsom administration is trying to figure out exactly where he sets that marker on the appropriate amount of spending. You said at the top, $15 billion. There's even more in the cash reserve that's a little bit more restricted. So there's a lot of money right now. The economy has produced a lot of tax revenues. Tops on the list, I'd say, probably is health care. There are a number of Democrats in Sacramento who would like to see an expansion of Medi-Cal. That's the state's version of Medicaid.
Right.
Certainly, they would like to see a universal system. The cost estimates of that are quite large and could not be done in a single year. And that, I think, is still going to be something talked about. But expanding Medi-Cal, for example, to those who are in the United States illegally, undocumented immigrants, that would have a very big price tag. That could be in the billions, or at least into the billion-dollar range. Does Governor-elect Newsom support that? Does he want to do that? That's an ongoing expense, too, as compared to what I said earlier about a one-time thing. You'd have to have money over several years for that. And let's keep in mind, the surplus money that we're talking about, the $15 billion or so, depending on if it comes in, is not necessarily going to be there the year after the coming year. And so that's really the push here. And I think Newsom is going to have to figure out what his priorities are, how to sell those, and how to communicate with Democrats in the legislature who may have felt as though Governor Brown wasn't willing to spend the money that they wanted to. That's not to say Governor Brown didn't spend money, but that there were a lot of programs, especially ones cut during the recession, that they would like to see further restored.
Right. We're going to have to watch for that. So I'm curious to know, though, just as a parting thought here, John, if you can talk about the tightrope that the state legislature and Governor-elect Newsom is going to have to walk on spending, because there are fears about recession. You talk about whether or not this money comes in, whether or not we're going to realize this big projected surplus. Obviously, everything is sort of contingent on what higher earners, how their investment portfolios do. We're worried about a recession. And there is some talk even among Assembly Democrats. I'm seeing Assemblyman Phil Ting saying, you know, even $3 billion in additional spending could cause a deficit during a recession. How are Democrats negotiating this tightrope?
Well, they're watching it, I think, and they're cognizant that they may have to walk that tightrope. I would say that we know that the state's income tax revenues are pretty volatile. We depend on the highest of the high-income earners. We've made some changes to kind of make that a little bit less dependent in the up-and-down roller coaster, but we still are very dependent on them. All the cash reserves that we have could be wiped out in a matter of 18 months in a bad economic situation. And I will tell you, Governor Brown, who I talked to up at his Northern California ranch a couple of weeks ago, said to me, you know, I think we may already be in a recession and we just don't have the data yet. So I think there's a real warning sign as everybody comes back to Sacramento on Monday. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens.
John Meyer, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Coming right up here on Air Talk, we're going to talk about something completely different. Hangover remedies. What's your favorite food? We want to hear your calls. Back after this break. Well, if you've ever woken up after a night of revelry with a throbbing head, churning stomach, and a general distaste for being awake, you've probably also wished there was some kind of hangover cure. And that's what we're going to talk about next here on Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle. But, you know, as you try to peel your face from the sheets, silently wondering whether anyone got the license plate number of the bus that feels like it hit you the night before, you wonder that, you know, aside from traveling back in time and choosing not to drink as much, why there has not yet been found a surefire remedy developed to help mitigate the symptoms of a hangover other than simply not drinking too much. That said, everyone has an answer when you ask them what their preferred remedy is for taking the edge off. So today we are going to assume that the answer is food. Always food. A piece in LA Taco about the city's best hangover food got us thinking, what is your go-to hangover remedy? Seriously, what do you nosh on to take the edge off? Maybe you're not noshing on it at all. Maybe you're in the Pedialyte family. We'll go there. We want to know from you, though, first. Give us a call, 866-888. And keep doing the pledge drive number, guys. I'm sorry about that. 866-893-KPCC. I'll do it one more time so there is no confusion. 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Do you make it yourself? Do you go to a restaurant to get it? What is the dish? And if it's served in a restaurant, where is it? We can maybe build a map of the best hangover food in Southern California with your help. Again, that phone number, 866-893-5722. With me to discuss this most important topic are two of my colleagues, the foodiest of the foodie in the KPCC LAist newsroom. We've got Elena Shatkin, who's the food editor at KPCC and LAist. Elena, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Kyle. Could you turn the lights down in here? It's really bright, and could you maybe talk a little quieter? It's just everything's hurting
head. I don't need it from you. My head is throbbing. I don't need it from you, Elena. I don't need it. I don't need it from you either. Quincy Shurismith, digital assistant producer for the KPCC in-person team. Hello, Quincy.
How's it going? I, for one, am all ready to go.
Oh, wow. He found his method. Maybe he found what you like to call the sop it up method, Elena. So talk us through, like, you got to sort of do some categorization here. What are we talking about when we're talking about sop it up?
All right. Like you said, there are some main categories of ways people attempt to treat hangovers. I won't say cure because there's really no cure but water and time.
This is a scientific show. We are committed to science.
100% science, 100% cures. Of the time. The sop it up method is basically a bland, you know, food. Bland carbs, some people prefer that. Rice, toast, bread, bagels, tortillas.
The brat diet, I've heard
of. Yeah, includes apples, applesauce, bananas, rice, toast, you know. And then, of course, there's the other, you know, sop it up method, which is greasy foods. They totally 180 degree opposite direction. Cheese steaks, huevos rancheros, chilaquiles, burgers, fries, the traditional British breakfast with beans, toast, sausage, whatever. And all of it, in my opinion, whichever route you go, should be eaten with coffee. Strong and black.
Ooh, the coffee part is a little too much for me. I'm wondering if that's like going to put people over the edge. I mean, you know, I get the sop it up with the grease. Like, that's my go-to. I think this is, I think I'm firmly in the sop it up category. But coffee?
I like it. Nice, strong, wakes you up. But I get it. It could be a little much for sensitive stomachs.
Okay. So on the other hand, there's this whole subgenre of hangover cures. Subgenre, I don't want to demote it, Quincy, about soups. We, you know, there's so many great soup methods of curing hangovers.
Definitely. I mean, you know, I think soups kind of fall under two kind of categories too, right? There's the something similar to the like lighter things, right? That's going to be your like, you know, I enjoy like rice porridges, pho, like these noodle soups or
that
are congee, right? Like things are just there to nourish
miso.
You, right? Like that are light. But I have a spicy tooth, as it were. And so sometimes that's, I feel like that's kind of the other end, right? You have your like boat noodles or like a nice spicy Korean sundubu jjigae, like a sundubu stew. I know there was the kimchi jjigae, the kimchi stews that was just written about by Dakota Kim in The LAist. And those are going to be like both nourishing just because of like the liquid and broth, but also a little bit of the shock and awe to wake you back up through that spicy and that chili flavors. I love that kind of thing.
Is any of this jogging any hangover memories for you? I don't want memories of the hangover we can leave aside, but the hangover food hopefully is good. We want you to tell us about it. What is your favorite hangover food? Give us a call. Tell us about it. 866-893-5722. Again, 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Pippi on the AirTalk page, another soup, Quincy, menudo, the best and tastiest hangover cure ever, writes Pippi. Sophia in Santa Monica joins us. You're a bartender.
Yeah, I've been a bartender for about 20 years in New York and L.A., and I got to be the bearer of bad news. A lot of it is just you could prevent the hangover to begin with by drinking water with every drink you have the night before. That's the little bartender trick. Of course, there's things like hair of the dog, and there's, you know, as far as food is concerned, the bad news also is that you got to eat things that are healthy for you, and that'll bounce you back a lot sooner. It's just who wants to eat, you know, greens the second they wake up, right?
Are you actually advocating hair of the dog as that was the first hangover remedy you mentioned? It is good for your bottom line as a bartender.
I will say, I mean, just a little bit of what you were drinking the night before, it does take the edge off, and it kind of normalizes you. Just as bartenders, we'd always have a shot the next day, even if you didn't want to, and there's something about it. It mellows you out. It's not food, but if you could just drink water as much as you possible the night before, it doesn't matter what you drink or for how long, just hydrate.
Have you gotten used to this because you know as a bartender, I don't know how much of your own product you end up consuming on a nightly basis. If you know someone buys a round of drinks for the bar, I mean, do you have to like ride this line yourself?
Yeah, I mean, well, it depends on the place, and all of the bartenders collectively would say no, we don't drink behind the bar. But the truth of the matter is, as long as it's an 80 proof whiskey, most bartenders are drinking it. I hate to say it.
Sophia in Santa Monica, thank you so much for joining us. A bartender weighing in with expert advice.
It's good to have that kind of honesty. You know?
I know, exactly. Nothing that can solve this totally. Nothing that can totally cure this thing.
I do want to note that soups do add that hydration element also.
I was going to say,
we have not talked about soups enough.
We haven't got enough. I wanted to just mention one of the things that was in the LA Taco piece that is a favorite. I don't know that I've had it as hangover food, but samgyetang, the Korean young whole chicken soup, which is it's served in ginger and ginseng and garlic. There are like dates floating around in there. It's not inoffensive. I don't want to say it's bland, but it's also because it's very tasty, but it's also not super overpowering. It's really pleasant.
I mean, definitely. And LA is a great place to get any Korean soup that ends in a tang or jjigae, right? Like which goes from the like light kind of nourishing while you're sick foods all the way to like a nice, rich, spicy, meaty stew.
Yeah, there are a lot of great options. Again, as Quincy mentioned, there's, you know, the lighter kind of things, and there are the very, you know, the heavier things. Like there is haejeongguk, which is a great Korean soup. It literally means soup to chase a hangover. I'm sorry for my terrible pronunciation. And it's usually a broth made by boiling ox bones. You boil them for hours with fermented soybean paste, garlic, and other spices. You add some meat, cabbage, other vegetables. There's seolongtang, which is a light-colored, milky-looking Korean broth. Again, ox bones and brisket, and you season it at your table, maybe with, you know, different kinds of pepper, garlic, sesame oil. And then there's, like, kimchi jjigae, which is, you know, a much, like, a volcanic, hearty, red stew, bubbling, you know, made with really intensely fermented kimchi, right? So super ripe kimchi and just, you know, with pork, tofu, chili pepper flakes, ginger, scallions.
Yeah, right. A bunch of different great things. All you want, nothing you don't. I'm a big fan of Korean stews. We're going to come back. We are talking hangover cures. We're going to try and be the hair of the dog here on Air Talk. Back in 1 minute. We want to hear from you at 866-893-KPCC. What is your favorite hangover cure? Come back right in a minute and tell us. We only discuss matters of national importance when Kyle Stokes guest hosts Air Talk. I'm sitting in for Larry Mantle, and with the trust of Larry Mantle himself, I am talking about hangover cures today here on the show. Want to hear from you. What is your favorite go-to hangover cure? If it's a restaurant, where do you get it? Give us a call, 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page. Jimmy from Long Beach, you're on Air Talk.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, what's your go-to?
My go-to, I don't know if it's really appropriate, but...
I'll go for it.
It's always appropriate here when Kyle hosts Air Talk.
A little bit of marijuana and a double-double from In-N-Out, fries, and a yellow Gatorade.
Oh, the bud method.
I like it. You've got the hydration, you've got the grease bomb, and you've got the chill relaxer with the weed.
Something to just soothe the pain a little bit away.
Oh, yeah.
Which one's doing the work, Jimmy? The marijuana, the burger, or the drink?
They all do. They all work together to balance everything out to make life bearable again.
It's a cocktail. Interesting.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Jimmy from Long Beach, thank you so much for calling
one
in.
One of them, you're thrown off.
Yeah. Really? So have you tried that?
Yes. It took a little bit of time and perfection to get it all together.
Experimentation.
Well, naturally, you had to do the research.
Our producer wants to call this the Jimmy meal now, so we can brand it as such. Thank you, Jimmy. If you're all right, we'll contact you with the trademark rights. Robert in Playa del Rey, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, I got to go with the L.A. original, the bacon breakfast burrito from Lucky Boy in Pasadena.
A few short blocks, walking distance from KPCC.
We are big fans. I had it during our holiday week here.
We have it. It's a tradition,
every pledge
actually.
Drive, they get it for us.
Exactly, especially during the first
you're
ones.
Hungover, yeah.
Yeah, you're...
Yeah, we're hungover from pledging.
We don't drink during pledge drive. Like, you know, throw that out there. We're
Speak
not
for
buzzed.
Yourself.
Oh, boy.
I'm kidding. Well,
Robert, thank you very much for that local favorite here at KPCC. Michael from Long Beach, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's your go-to hangover cure?
We call it pseudo menudo. You take a crushed tomato base stock. You throw in a couple handfuls of chicharrones, some spicy sausage, and with... Boiling nice and well, you poach eggs into it.
Hot damn, that sounds great.
That's amazing. The chicharrones, that really makes it for me.
Yeah.
The egg, too. I'm a big fan of the egg in the soup. The egg in the soup really does some work.
Yeah, and there's so many other good Mexican soups, too. There's menudo, which we just mentioned. There's carne en su jugo, which is a popular beef soup from Jalisco. It's a, you know, it's basically it means meat in its own juices. So it's beef broth, chopped up pieces of beef, beans, and, you know, some versions have tomatillos. You can garnish it with all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. There's pozole, there's chile latte de pollo, there's all sorts of things.
And then there's Michael's pseudo menudo. Where did this recipe come from, Michael?
Love it.
Years ago, my father used to sail down to Ensenada on the Newport Ensenada race. And
yeah,
that's what they had the next day.
Wow! So this was something that you had served to you, or was
on the boat? You'd throw everything into a pot, boil it up. It was quick, simple, single pot, small galley, and served it to the crew.
I love it. I love it. Pseudo Menudo, another Air Talk original hangover remedy. I don't know why
scheme.
I just claimed it for Air Talk.
We need to try
Michael,
it.
Michael, thank you so much. Appreciate it. We do need to try it. Do you think we could have a cook-off here or something like that? Hangover cures? Try and decide whether it's the soup or the sop it up method that would
I'm
do
in.
It?
Would we require most of the staff to come hungover so that they can get the true scientific feedback?
Happy hour Thursday night, you know.
I feel like HR would not approve.
I don't think they approve of this conversation. Elena, some of you actually put out a call on Twitter for people to write in with their favorite hangover cures.
Yes, I did. And we got some good answers.
Okay.
You know, we got a big greasy fry-up or another drink the next day. Rob Eshman writes, seltzer, Advil, fresh air, 2.5 milligrams of THC, seltzer, repeat.
The healthy method.
Here's an interesting one. Pickle juice from Ariel Plotchta. She writes, according to a very nice elderly man from Kazakhstan I recently interviewed, seems legit.
I've heard that one before, not from an elderly man from Kazakhstan, from an American, actually.
And then there were a few people on Twitter, Karen Tongson, Luis Gomez, who all told us that, you know, exercise. They go out in the fresh air, exercise. I mean, that's way more ambitious than I personally get. But yeah, that could theoretically work.
I literally do the opposite of exercise by eating a nice greasy breakfast. So I don't know how that's going to work out for me.
It just goes to show that there's no one way to cure a hangover. Brooks, let's see, where are you, Brooks, calling in from Beverlywood? What's your go-to?
It's going to sound crazy, but it is a root beer float.
What?
Beer and vanilla. Yes, it works every time. Something about the ice cream that coats your stomach and the the bubbles in the root beer, the carbonation. It sounds nuts, but it is quick and simple, and it works every time.
Wow. Can I just affirm what this caller said about dairy coating your stomach? Often when I was queasy, I liquid dairy, like ice cream or milkshakes, it just has like a kind of Pepto-y, Melanta effect where it just coats the inside of your tummy. It helps.
Ooh, that's just the opposite of what I want. I don't want dairy in my stomach.
And for some of us that are lactose intolerant, if alcohol is already making your stomach not do too well, I don't know that a milkshake or milk or that much ice cream will soothe the situation. But if you're lucky enough to be lactase persistent and can take it, that sounds like it'd be really great.
Sorry about that. I just wanted to throw Esther Tang, the LA Times food writer, tweeting in, milk thistle before you start your night of drinking. So a pre-hangover cure, glass of water before going to bed. That's the post. Ernie writes in a smoothie of kale, spinach, slice of pineapple, spoonful of turmeric, anti-inflammatory and healthy. Another vote for pickle juice on the Air Talk page as well.
Yeah, and we got several people suggesting Pedialyte, which, you know, basically Pedialyte just released this new fizzy little thing. So you no longer have to go to the drugstore and pretend you're getting something for your sick kid or something. You can just get these fizzy drops, put it in some, you know, water. These fizzy packets of powder, put them in your water. Boom, you have cherry or raspberry flavored Pedialyte to replace electrolytes or something sciencey like that?
Absolutely. Perfect. I've definitely done the Pedialyte thing, not because of a hangover, but because of food poisoning. It definitely worked.
Sure.
I felt very strange. It was food poisoning. And I felt a little weird going into the baby product aisle, but it worked. It definitely, definitely worked.
Is that your secret hangover cure, Kyle? No. I was told to ask you, what do you do about hangovers?
Elena,
you must reveal this.
I'll never tell. My expert panel of hangover doctors, Quincy Shura-Smith and Elena Shatkin, both of us here at the KPCC LAS newsroom, here with news you can use, hangover cures. Thanks for all of your suggestions. Wonderful talking hangover cures with you on Air Talk. Larry Mantle back with you tomorrow with Air Talk and Film Week. I'm Kyle Stokes. Have a great day.